Good morning, and welcome to the 13th Annual Healthcare Dealmakers Conference and the first year we've brought together healthcare leaders from across the country in a virtual setting. We want to thank our 2020 conference sponsors for their continued support of HDC and for making today possible, as well as a warm welcome to all of our clients, friends, and attendees engaging with us today and during the 2020 HDC digital experience. We invite you to participate in today's sessions by using the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers or for any technical assistance throughout today's events. Please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios for supporting materials and access to today's presentations. Today's events are being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours at www.healthcaredealmakers.com. Without further ado, please welcome our 2020 conference chair, Bobby Guy.
Good morning and welcome to the 13th annual Healthcare Dealmakers Conference. We're happy to have you with us. I am Bobby Guy, the conference chair and MC this year, which is an interesting thing for a virtual conference, right? Yesterday was day one and was an innovation competition centering around a pitch competition run by Health Wildcatters. The virtual pitch competition went very well, and congratulations to Atea Medical for taking first place in the competition. Today, as day two, is our M&A day with panels and networking. As we were finalizing everything for the conference in February, I was very much looking forward to seeing everyone in Dallas and shaking hands with many of you. Wow, is this a different world? The wild world of virtual conferencing. So we've turned the conference into a digital experience this year that will run throughout the year. We're doing frequent half an hour HDC market updates through the year. We've launched the 10-minute Health Bizcast at www.healthbizcast.net, that's B-I-Z, about 6 weeks ago, which is exploring ways to make healthcare better. Season one is live and more episodes are coming over the next few weeks. We will be doing a live podcast in June. We have a virtual fireside chat with the leadership team at Mercy Health Ensemble Healthcare in September. It was originally our keynote for this conference. And then we're looking at some additional events in the fall, potentially cocktail parties in a few cities around the country where our audience is based, when hopefully my kids will be back in real college, in real classes in the fall. So let's talk about the agenda for today. Each of the panels is intended to be short and snappy for the virtual world. We'll also have some quick film vignettes about funny experiences we're all having trying to work remotely. We have a morning session today with two panels. Then we have a lunch and keynote, and then we have an afternoon session with three panels. If this conference was in person, you could think of the morning sessions as being in Salon 1 at the hotel, then lunch in Salon 2, and then the afternoon sessions in Salon 3. There are separate links for the morning set, the keynote, and then the afternoon set. The links are in the morning's reminder email that everyone will have gotten for the conference, and I'll announce at the end of each group of sessions to move to the next salon. In addition, we have a survey on the platform that we'd like all of our audience to take about general economic conditions and about healthcare M&A and what they think is going to happen. It's very short. It's only six questions. It will take you only a minute or two to complete. We'd love your insights. And we plan to tell you about the results at one of the digital events over the course of the year. The responses are all anonymous. You can access that on the platform, and I will give you more information at one of the breaks if anyone has trouble finding it. So I want to talk about leadership for a minute for our attendees. The group that's here is a very important group for healthcare, for finance, for innovation, and for our country right now. It's important to take a moment to reflect on the current crisis and how it relates to everyone in this virtual room. Managing crisis always comes down to leadership, and you are leaders in healthcare and in innovation and in finance. Your career has been preparing you to lead at such a time as this in our country, and your contribution is critical. Thank you for being here. be encouraged, and we ask that you go forth and lead. This is your time to make a difference and your time to change the world. Now I want to start with our opening panel. Our first panel today is a view from the investors, straight talk from private equity and investment banks. Our moderator is Jessica Zeiger, who's a partner in Polsinelli's Kansas City office, specializing in healthcare finance. One of my favorite things about Jessica is that she often works together with the M&A teams on our deals. And her finance background gives her a unique perspective on the broader trends in M&A and the healthcare markets. So, Jessica, I'm turning it over to you.
Good morning. Thank you for that introduction, Bobby. Good morning, everyone. I am so pleased to be with you all today, even if it's just digitally as we continue this great tradition of the Dealmakers Conference in what is really a new and crazy environment. Setting the stage for the rest of the day, we have three great panelists this morning who are going to give us their view of the current market for healthcare transactions. To avoid too many virtual handoffs, each panelist will give you their brief personal introduction and then a high-level overview of what they're seeing in the current market, what deals are being marketed, which ones are actually getting done, what providers are hot and not now dealing with what we're dealing with. If you have any questions as we go along, please feel free to submit them and we'll do our best to address them at the end of the panel, time permitting. Now I'll turn it over to Dan. Dan, please add yourself to the presentation, introduce yourself, and tell us what you've been seeing.
Hi, yeah, it's Dan DeSells. I'm the co-head of healthcare investment banking at Jefferies. Jefferies is a 120-person healthcare group, so one of the largest, not the largest, healthcare investment bank group on the street. We've been very active in healthcare since we joined Jefferies in 2009, one of the leaders in M&A and financing of those M&A situations. We're seeing we had a massive first quarter of activity, and we're starting to see an increase in M&A dialogue as people feel that the corner here may be starting to turn. We've actually been active in the financing. We reopened the financing market in April with a couple of transactions for in the retail space, and then also for the only single B healthcare transaction that was done for Surgery Partners in Nashville, which was a liquidity financing. We're starting to see more M&A dialogue between strategics and targets, largely driven by strategics, but we're also seeing the sponsors starting to think about when the timing to launch is. We do expect in the late summer and the fall to have a busier market with transactions beginning to get going. Is that enough of an introduction?
That's perfect. And a perfect segue to Jesse. Jesse, can you add yourself to the presentation? Tell us a little bit who you are. And Jesse is our equity investor representative. So what are you all seeing? What are you looking at? What are you looking for differently now?
Yeah, good morning. First, just in terms of introductions, Jesse Bland, a partner with Heritage Group. We're a Nashville-based growth equity firm focused on healthcare exclusively. And within healthcare, we invest in healthcare services and healthcare IT businesses and really anything along that technology enabled continuum. So our portfolio really runs the gamut from pure software companies all the way to hospice providers, other care delivery service type providers. So we've got a pretty good purview in terms of different sectors and how this pandemic's been impacting various aspects of the broader healthcare market. And our model is a bit unique, and I think also gives us a little bit of an additional perspective in this current environment, in that all of our capital, or the vast majority of our capital, comes from large strategic LPs, strategic healthcare organizations. So we have 15 health systems that in the aggregate manage over 600 acute care facilities. Think about it as roughly 15% of the acute care market. We also have 9 health plans that cover roughly 45 million lives across various books of business. And then other ancillary solution providers like Cerner on the EMR front, Cardinal Health on distribution. So it's been interesting as we've, you know, not only spent a lot of time with our portfolio companies since the pandemic broke out, but also with our LPs in terms of what they're seeing on the front line and, you know, different types of challenges or dislocation that are taking place, you know, across the market, kind of irrespective of size of company. So I've been with Heritage for about a decade since we raised our first fund. You know, we probably have a little bit of a different perspective than Dan in that deals are still getting done. Although I think the deals that are getting done, you know, now and probably even into the early summer really aren't indicative of how folks are transacting in, you know, the face of the pandemic. I think it's a lot of spillover from processes or conversations that started much earlier in the year. You know, we on the equity side are just being a lot more cautious right now in terms of identifying new platforms and thinking about, you know, deploying capital into businesses on a net new basis. Thankfully, our portfolio is pretty well capitalized. We spent the first month really of the breakout here trying to wrap our arms around, you know, each business and understand potential headwinds that may, you know, continue or emerge and make sure that we're shoring up balance sheets and the like. But, you know, once we got past that, we've really been refocusing on investment strategy. And we do want to continue to deploy capital. We're open for business. But we, like I think many of our peers, are just being a lot more cautious right now on new opportunities. And I think the, you know, the sell side is likely in the same boat, right? Where it's not a great time to go market your business. And it tends to be a bit of a, you know, negative dynamic, or, you know, you tend to have a little bit of the challenge in terms of really understanding what a business is going to do in the near term. And so you tend to only see businesses that need
Thanks, Jesse. Can everyone hear me still? Perfect. Let's turn it over to Vin. Vin, can you add yourself to the conversation? I know you're not only taking part in active deals, but you're seeing proposals and prospectuses come through. Can you let us know, introduce yourself first, of course, and then let everybody know what you've been seeing.
Sure. Thanks, Jessica. Hi, everyone. I'm Vin Fan. I'm based in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm a partner and I lead the healthcare transaction practice for BDO. Our fully dedicated healthcare transaction professionals have diverse backgrounds in healthcare and have a significant amount of experience executing transactions, serving private equity firms, corporate strategics, founders of highly successful businesses. We focus on both buy side and sell side financial due diligence in connection with healthcare transactions. We've done a number of physician practices, retail healthcare, hospitals, managed care organizations, accountable care organizations, healthcare IT, and healthcare business services. So our experience really runs the gamut within the healthcare sector. So when the shutdown of the economy started across the country in March because of COVID-19, we saw a number of deals that were in process just get put on hold as businesses and private equity firms shifted their business, shifted their focus on navigating the impact of COVID. We did see some deals that were near the finish line pre-COVID-19 closed during the midst of the pandemic. And these deals were largely funded by cash. And in certain instances, a larger escrow was renegotiated by the buyer. And in addition to that, the escrow measurement period, you know, was for a FY21 or some later period. And like Jesse said, these deals were already in discussions and they were very close to the finish line. And the quality of these businesses were very high prior to COVID-19. And you know, the management expects these businesses to largely bounce back to pre-COVID-19 levels. We have seen over the last several weeks, a meaningful uptick in deal activity. From a sell side perspective, we're working with several large healthcare organizations platforms to prepare them to go to market in Q3 and Q4 of this year, with the strategy of being first platform on the market to capture the potential uptick in deal activity. These platforms include some DSOs, or dental service organizations. We are working with several large autism ABA providers and a few risk-taking physician practices in terms of a sales side, and helping them prepare to go to market in the latter part of this year. And these are very highly successful businesses prior to COVID-19. And you know, while they've had some impact to volumes and revenue during this period, management expects a significant rebound in the latter part of this year. And due to COVID-19 and its impact to earnings, the sellers are expecting there to be some more creative deal structures, such as larger earnouts and more contingencies placed around the transaction value. And you know, from a buy side perspective, I'm still surprised to see a good number of roll-ups in the retail healthcare sector, most notably dental. And we are seeing more transaction buy-side activities involving physician practices that are reimbursed under a value-based care model. In fact, we have two or three buy-side engagements that we just kicked off in this sector. And last, and not surprising, we're seeing a little bit more activity in the addiction treatment sector as well. And these are largely smaller add-ons as larger platforms look to strategically deploy capital. And most of the buy side transactions that we are currently working on are funded, you know, based on reading of the LOI with cash, along with some level of escrow or earnout. And, you know, they contain no financing contingencies. You know, from my perspective, it's still too early to assess the impact of EBITDA, of COVID-19 to EBITDA multiples. You know, my expectation is that the EBITDA multiples will largely remain unchanged from levels pre-COVID in the near term. However, I expect the earnings base that are applied to the that the EBITDA multiples will be applied to will be lower, just given the impact of COVID-19. And I understand there will be some type of adjustments to, you know, to EBITDA, you know, from COVID-19. But you know, those analyses will have to be very granular and rely a lot on management's cash flow projections and forecasts. So beyond just evaluating the historical quality of earnings of these businesses from a diligence perspective, COVID-19 has really reinforced us to evaluate the quality of the businesses as well, such as evaluating management's post-COVID-19 reopening plans and forecasts, analyzing weekly cash flows, and understanding the experience of management and navigating, you know, these complex challenges, and understanding the market in which the business operates as part of the due diligence process. So, you know, the emphasis now when we think about diligence is much more on kind of what the business looks like going forward compared to what they were pre-COVID-19. And I think there's going to be a lot of analysis and work around understanding, you know, management's rest of year forecasts and their plans to reopen the business. So Jessica, these are some of the things that we're seeing just from a financial diligence perspective and from an M&A perspective.
No, that's great. And a good segue, Jesse, your audio cut out a little bit at the end. So I'm wondering, I know you gave us a high level description of it, but tell us in a little bit more detail from the equity investor side, feeding off of what Vin was sharing, how the diligence, the focus is changing as you all are looking at potential targets.
Yeah, great. And hopefully you can hear me better now. So it really runs across a few dimensions, right? I think we're being a lot more thoughtful on just near to medium term impact on the sector, a given business may be, you know, operating in, than we were a month ago. So anything, you know, selling into the employer market, I think could be challenged in a couple ways, just as unemployment spikes. You know, a lot of these businesses, they have their revenue based on number of employees covered or lives covered. So that's naturally going to go down. It's hard to forecast exactly where the unemployment rate is going to shake out and stabilize, but, you know, and that could cut differently across different segments of the broader, you know, U.S. Economy. But we're still very cautious about things that are purely facing the employer segment, generally because of that dynamic. And I also think you're going to see a big slowdown in just new purchasing decisions pretty much across every vertical. But in, you know, the employer market in particular, there's so much seasonality associated with bookings in a given year that, you know, it's hard to know. It's hard to place a bet today on a business that isn't going to know what it really sold in 2020 until much later in the year. And then we've also got this compounding, you know, cloud around unemployment. So that's caused us to be a lot more cautious in that segment. And then as we think about, you know, valuing companies, it is really tough. I think over the last decade, the market's moved more and more toward giving credit for, you know, future earnings or revenue, certainly kind of current year if you want to be competitive in a process. I think that's all changing right now because, and we're seeing this with our portfolio companies, you know, just because you have a budget in place or a forecast in place that you probably created in December, January, that means nothing now. And so we've really got to get a lot more granular, you know, to Ben's point, and really understand whether it's a multi-site service business or a software business, you know, exactly how are you going to crosswalk from where you are today to where you're projecting? And, you know, I think there's also an increased focus just on customer churn, whether that's, you know, a patient even if the markets open back up to like the procedures, I still think patients are going to be more cautious to engage and utilize the system for a while. And how long does that take to smooth out? We don't know. But in general, I'd summarize by saying, you know, we are much more focused on what, you know, the rest of 2020 looks like for each company. And that's probably different depending on, you know, how COVID has impacted the business to this point. But unless we've got a lot of conviction and we feel like, you know, valuation and structure is appropriate relative to the risk, we're not going to be willing to stick our neck out there on a deal or on a business that, you know, could be materially impacted, you know, through the balance of 2020. So we'd rather see the dust settle a bit, you know, before we deploy too much capital in that environment.
Thank you, Dan. My favorite part of the conversation we had a few days ago was that your take is a little different. You're open for business. You're ready to pull the truck up and unload all the money, right? Can you jump in here and give us your more optimistic view of the deal market?
Well, I mean, you know, it's not for everybody. Not every business has been impacted the same. We're open for financing. We are very active with M&A. It's larger transactions. We got, you know, we sold a business to TPG in late March that all the diligence was done virtually. It was a behavioral business. It sold for a little over $1.2 billion. Very active auction. There were multiple parties at the end that were fully done with that deal. As someone mentioned, all equity check, no financing commitment at the time. The financing market has improved significantly since this all began, but a lot of businesses have looked at, you know, the first quarter and looked at, you know, different time periods over the quarter and are feeling, I think, a lot more optimistic. I think there are winners like home health and telehealth. They're doing phenomenal, you know, as a demand for their services in this environment. And some of the larger strategics that don't rely on a lot of leverage for a transaction, leverage meaning, you know, multiples, are looking and saying, hey, we're doing okay, and we want to, you know, continue to grow. And that on the financing side, it's definitely impacting the terms of the what we would look at from a financing, but we're definitely open for financing the right deals for the right clients. And from a committed standpoint, obviously on the best efforts side, you know, the Surgery Partners deal was done. It was a small deal, $120 million financing, but we had over $1.5 billion of demand for that deal. So the market's open for the right situation, but not everybody is being impacted the same. But we are very bullish and open.
Can you tell us a little bit about what makes a deal capable of being done in this market? What are you seeing as far as the trends maybe that are continuing to make deals a success or trends that you think are changing in order to be able to access those markets?
Well, from an M&A perspective, it'd be, you know, business that's showing that it has, that is not being significantly negatively impacted by the pandemic. or is actually, demand for that service picked up from the pandemic. Telemedicine is a perfect example of that. In healthcare and obviously we're in technology in general. And on the financing side, it's the right company again, from a credit perspective is going to, do well or do okay in this environment. But also the financing terms need to be a little bit, more flexible than they had been in the past. But there was one LBO, not in healthcare, that was done during the pandemic, and it was a business that that obviously was not as negatively impacted as others. And pricing, as I understand, in that deal went well. And there's more OID in the financing commitments. There's more flex in the financing commitments. So there'll be less leverage than there had been in the past. But it's, as long as the company has a plan and is going to, I think, not be, as I said, as negatively impacted. I think the market on the M&A and the financing side are open. And the valuations we're seeing on the strategic, we're working with a couple of strategic public companies that are buying large, billion-dollar type assets right now, and the valuations are as strong as they had been for those assets. They're just, they're not broad auctions; they're one-off discussions.
Vin, do you want to add to that a little bit? When we're talking about valuations and the types of diligence that is being reviewed in the deal structures, what are you seeing differently for folks who want to be able to access those markets?
Yeah, sure. So, in terms of the deal structures, I'm seeing a lot more kind of signing with delayed closings. I think that will become more common. As I mentioned earlier, I think that a larger portion of the purchase price will, be structured as earnouts and measured based on, results in FY21 or even some later period. And in some instances, even seller financing, to kind of get the deal done. And in addition, there may be even a lot more kind of contingencies around the deal values that we're seeing. But in the last 2 or 3 weeks, like I said, we're seeing a lot more cash deals with very little or to no financing contingencies and management retaining a larger portion of the equity going forward. I think these deals highlight management and the company's confidence in their ability to right the ship, if you will.
No, that's a great point. Jesse, can you weigh in there? I know we're getting into a little bit more detail about the focus of each individual deal. And what I'm hearing from everyone is that it's going to be a very particular analysis in order to decide, whether you're willing to move forward, even more so than it ever was before.
Yeah, I think that's right. The best assets are still going to be able to transact. I totally agree with that. I think COVID has maybe refocused what the best assets means. And again, it's largely going to be driven by subsector. So the behavioral health deal, that Dan mentioned, that's just a great business in a white hot sector and could have traded in probably any environment. And so those types of deals, they're fewer and far between, but they're going to get done. And there's enough dry powder and liquidity in the market to support, good valuations for those types of businesses. I think where you will see a big drop off is in more opportunistic situations. Pretty much any deal you could bring to market over the last 5 years could get done, even if there's a fair amount of hair or a lot of pro forma massaging to get to EBITDA that you're trying to sell off of. I just think that environment's going to dry up pretty materially, already has, and probably will continue to face pressure on a relative basis over 2020 and even 2021. So I just think deal activity and volume will naturally go down, but the best deals are still going to get done. And I agree that COVID has impacted how the investor universe is thinking about different sectors. We're investors in a large, kind of one of the largest telehealth platforms, and demand has just been insane for that company, both in terms of utilization and growth. But, you know, we're getting a lot of inbound interest from strategic and financial sources. So I agree that there will be pockets of the market that are going to have a lot of attention and demand, and that there's a lot of dry capital. But investors are generally going to only do those types of deals and move that quickly and support, you know, historical terms when there's a lot of conviction around that particular business or the sector. And they're not going to do it as much on an opportunistic basis as they have.
Great. We did get one audience question. I think, Jesse, we can start with you. The group is wondering how long it's going to take capital that's currently on the sidelines to really come back in into the market. What's your view on that?
Yeah, again, I think it depends on the type of capital and the asset class. You know, early stage venture is probably going to be the long pole in the tent. If you have some of these these large businesses that have, you know, fundamental, like long-term strong fundamentals, like Surgery Partners, I mean, volume's not going to go out of ASCs and back in hospitals over the next decade. You know, that business is going to be pretty well protected, but it's got scale, it's got some fixed assets, you know, so that's a good credit business today. And, you know, I can understand why folks would step in kind of a pinch to provide liquidity. I think it could be a lot more challenging for businesses that are burning a lot of capital on more of a speculative business model. So it's really going to, it's going to depend on the asset class and then, you know, the underlying sector, right? Even if you have a really good independent hospital, you know, acute care business, that's going to be more challenging, I think, over the next 12 months to 18 months. So it kind of depends on all of those factors.
Dan, what's your view on this question? How long do you see it taking for capital that's currently on the sidelines to come back in?
Yeah, I think Jesse said it perfectly. It's all depends on, you know, the type of capital, the sector that person's going to. I mean, we're dealing with, you know, today constantly where people are trying to deploy capital. The first, you know, few weeks were, you know, we're dealing with a lot of sponsors trying to invest in other sponsor companies. So immediately there was capital coming off the sidelines. It was just kind of a question of what the return they're expecting on that capital and where they're trying to put it in the capital structure. But we haven't really seen, people stop trying to deploy capital. It's just a question of returns and where they're trying to put it in the capital structure. I think Jesse's point, it's going to be a long time to get back to, you know, anything that comes to market and the massive adjustments to EBITDA, people accepting that I think is getting back to that pre-COVID bullishness on adjustments and quality of businesses, I think is going to take a lot longer than probably anyone is expecting.
That's great. Vin, do you have any input on that question that you want to weigh in?
No, I think both Jesse and Dan, you know, explained it very well. I would just add that, you know, we're seeing a lot of new activity really with lower middle market, you know, private equity firms looking to invest in, you know, kind of early stage, value-based care type of physician practice models. I think that's, like Jesse said, it just depends on the asset and what business is being marketed. But I think, you know, I'm starting to see a lot more activity just within the lower middle market private equity funds as what I was seeing before COVID-19. So, I think Dan and Jesse said it well.
And from the sell side, what are you seeing folks accepting and understanding the higher level of capital, the greater expectations that folks are demanding in order to get these deals done?
Yeah, so I'm seeing it both from, you know, the buyer and the seller. The buyers are coming with, you know, cash transactions, no financing, contingencies. Sellers are accepting more risk around the transaction price and, you know, willing to accept the larger earnout. And, I think there's, you know, coming to meetings of the minds here from both parties. You know, I'm seeing working capital considerations, you know, being put into play, you know, deferred compensation to staff or doctors being negotiated as part of their working capital. You know, buyers are ensuring that there aren't any deferred vendor payment terms and inventory levels, you know, get renegotiated based on what the normal working capital levels are, you know, kind of going forward. And then also there's, you know, a lot of deferred CapEx because of COVID-19 and sellers aren't making the same investments in deferred CapEx. And that's why they're willing to take a larger portion of the purchase price in earnouts. But yeah, I think I'm absolutely seeing, you know, an expectation from both buyers and sellers that, you know, there's some sort of special deal structures that needs to be negotiated.
Great. Dan, we have one more audience question I would like you to weigh in on first. The group is wondering how recent events affect your view of putting debt in place from traditional or non-traditional lenders in order to get deals closed.
I'm sorry, can you say that? Ask that one more time.
Yeah, recent events affect your view of putting debt in place from traditional and non-traditional lenders in order to get a deal closed in this environment?
Yes, I think the big change that we're seeing is, you know, most of our LBO financings in the past year plus have been, you know, first, second lien structures. And what we're seeing now is a shift to first and bonds. So bonds are kind of back in the picture. And that's driven, I think, by the fact that a lot of those second liens were, you know, pre-placed with, you know, these large funds like an Ares. And I think some of those second lien investors are not as active as they were, you know, pre-COVID. So I would say that the first lien is more expensive than it has been, more flexible, more OID, and we're relying for the junior capital more on the bond market, which is, you know, more traditional, more accepting of, you know, focusing on the upside in the investment than the second lien market has been. So that's the big shift, is that's traditionally been first, second, and now I think in this environment we're back to the old days of first with a bond.
Jesse, what's your reaction to that?
I think it depends a lot on the size of the business. You know, for companies that have 50 million plus in EBITDA, it's just a different credit market. And it's also a different, I think, risk profile for the equity investor that's leading a deal in that kind of structure versus where we tend to play, which is companies that are super high growth, you know, 3 to 10 in EBITDA. So really true kind of sizable earnings is emerging when we, you know, transacted the business at the outset. And so we've got to be a lot more thoughtful around the right kind of capital structure for the company, given its growth objectives generally. And then with COVID, I think we're being probably more cautious about using a lot of leverage in deals. And so we're either doing one of two things, you know, over-equitizing and just expecting, you know, a higher cost of capital on our equity because we don't want to risk bringing in, you know, debt and having any kind of handcuffs around business flexibility or operational strategies, you know, post closing. And we also don't want to trip up on any kind of covenants due to things that are outside of our control, you know, in the event the pandemic really does continue to persist negatively. So that's one strategy. The other would be, to the extent we're going to use leverage, I'm probably going to favor more of a FinCo model where the cost of capital may be higher, but again, flexibility is going to be a lot higher as well than with a traditional regulated bank, because we just don't know how regulations are going to change, you know, in the face of this broader economic impact. Generally, I would think they would want to loosen, but you just never know. So that's been our approach generally in that part of the market.
Great, thank you. Vin, are you seeing the same thing in the proposals that you're seeing come in and the ones that you're working on?
Yeah, I'm seeing similar type items, but like I said, I'm seeing more cash transactions, at least in the last 2 or 3 weeks. But I think Jesse and Dan summed it up very well.
Perfect. Thank you. I think that brings us near to the end of the session section. This session, I don't have any more audience questions. Bobby, I can go ahead and turn it over to you to head off our next panel.
That's great. Thanks, Meg. So if you could see me in the break, what everybody would see is that I'm trying to arrange my camera so the guitar in the background will actually show up in the picture, but it's really hard because it's like in reverse, but never mind that. All right. Many thanks to the panelists. Great discussion about where the capital is. Sounds like Dan's pretty bullish on the capital and availability to come in for the right sectors. That's very encouraging to hear in an M&A market like what we're dealing with when we're looking at the numbers on the economy more generally. So this is exciting. Thanks to everyone, Jesse, for talking about the private equity perspective, and then Vin for giving us your thoughts around how these deal structures are going to work. So for each of the lightning round panelists, as I announce you, if you will bring yourself into the screen, that would be great. And I'll do you one at a time. You're coming up over the next few minutes. So now we're going to do the healthcare lightning round, perspectives at high speed. This is one of my favorite panels to do. And for the sake of making it easy to transition, as the MC and chair of the Dealmakers Conference, I will, I will be the moderator of this one to keep it sort of on pace. The reason this is fun is we have a great group, and it's a great format. Lightning round means that I'll ask a question of one of the panelists, and they have to fit their answer into 30 seconds. We thought about going with 15 seconds or two sentences, but in mercy on the moderator, that's me, we thought we would make it 30 seconds just to give it a little more room for answer. You'll get a lot of sound bites out of these. These are great things to follow up with the speakers on about after the event, including through LinkedIn introductions that you could be doing while we're online. We'll also expect to get a few controversial statements in the sound bites, so I think this will be fun. It will move fast, so what will happen is I'll direct a question to a panelist, usually, and then after that panelist answers, any other panelist can raise their hand and jump in and try to give a 15 to 30 second answer to it as well. So on the panel today, and if you'll let yourself in as I announce you, first we have Don Barbo, who is a managing director at VMG Healthcare. Don specializes in business valuations and expert testimony and litigation and dispute resolution for healthcare companies. Welcome, Don. Next, we have Connie Cagle. We have Connie Cagle, who's a member of BKD's healthcare group. She focuses on accounting and audit work for healthcare companies across the spectrum from life sciences to healthcare services providers. Then we have Justin DeWitt, who's a managing director at Graham Healthcare Capital, which is a private equity fund. Justin hails from my favorite city in the country, Nashville, Tennessee. And he's been the president of Residential Hospice in Michigan and then COO of Graham Healthcare Group's Hospice. Now we have Chris Gallagher, MD, who is the CEO of Access Physicians, which is a multi-specialty physician group focused on excellence in telemedicine. It's one of the largest inpatient telemedicine providers in the U.S. Next, we have Herb Midkiff, who is a partner at and leads consulting services at J. Taylor. He specializes in managed care contract negotiation analysis and in assisting capital planning and expansion projects for healthcare companies. And finally, we have Marshall Taylor from Houlihan Lokey. Marshall is a managing director at Houlihan and is head of healthcare financial and valuation advisory, where he works for healthcare providers and life science companies. All right, so into the lightning round. Here we go. Justin, let me take you first. So from the fun side, realizing that you only have 30 seconds, How long do you think it is before we see healthcare M&A come back, and why?
You know, we had a fruitful discussion just before this, Bobby, and I agree with what was said there. The lower middle market is active, and we haven't really seen much deterioration. I think it's back already. I really think it's an individual question. The larger markets have been slower to respond, and it's really dependent upon how, you know, the business has been impacted by the current environment and how people think behaviors are changing as a result, potentially for the long term.
Anybody else want to jump in on that one? Okay, I'll jump to Marshall. Marshall, when healthcare M&A does come back, and some of it is back right now, there are deals going on, how does it look different?
Yep. I do think this is probably related to what Justin's question was. But, you know, after working through their own companies and portfolio companies, our clients are getting a lot more aggressive. But I think it'll come back in waves. You know, as owners look to de-risk, there's an expectation, you know, that'll be opportunities in the near term. But also, we think that there's some of the better companies will be tested as they get to the Q2 interest payments. And so that'll create some opportunities for buyers, maybe for sellers, and even some of the best companies will probably be tested at the Q3 interest payment, depending on how this thing plays out. But I think it looks a lot different in terms of where people play, structure, and a lot of the different opportunities and communications and connections that people make across their platforms to be more vertically integrated.
So thinking about interest payments at Q2 and Q3, I think that's an interesting way to look at it. Anybody else want to jump in on that one? Okay, let me take it to Don. Don, what do you expect the cost of the capital to be as it comes back? Cheaper than it was or more expensive? And if it's a little bit different on each side, depending on the case, why?
Okay, Bobby, and you're limiting me to 15 seconds, correct?
You have 30 seconds.
Okay, and now we're 25 seconds into it. Anyway, so what I would say in general terms is it's difficult for me to believe that the cost of capital would go down, given that the cost of capital is a function of the risk associated with the business and the volatility of its future cash flows. So as companies emerge from the COVID environment, I think it's very much a case-by-case situation. Size could have a whole lot to do with it. Perhaps the smaller entities might be more vulnerable than a larger entity that could diversify its cash flows and its risk. So my key takeaways on this would be, I would imagine cost of capital would go up to some degree due to volatility and unknowns about how quickly any individual company could recover from the COVID period.
Anybody else want to jump in on that one? Love thoughts on how much the pricing moves up and what you're seeing. Okay, let's go to Chris. Chris, tell me what makes you passionate about Access Physicians and its mission in the new healthcare reality.
Sure. Thanks, Bobby. So our mission since our founding about 10 years ago has really been focused on providing quality physician with timely access to every patient.
Chris, you're breaking up. Hang on 1 second. Let's see if we can get your sound back as we so I can give you the full 30 seconds. Say something real quick so we can check it.
Hey, Bobby, coming through now?
Chris, there you go. Now you're back. Yep, going go back. For it.
Perfect. Well, I think just to make it quick, I know I've got less than 30 seconds here, but this has been a dramatic change for those who practice in telemedicine. And while the pandemic has been
Chris, I'm sorry. We're going to have to come back to this question, if you don't mind. You're going in and out. I'm going to ask our engineer to work on that while we keep rolling through. It was a great answer. I could tell just from your passion about the way you were delivering it. So, all right, let me move to Connie. So, Connie, when we look at the stimulus programs, many healthcare businesses have gotten stimulus loans that will be forgiven if they use the funds for the right purposes. Do you think most of them will be able to do this? And if not, what's the long-term effect?
Sure, I think the main concern with all of the different financial relief programs is, are you qualified to receive them in the first place? I know a lot of companies have been returning some of the funding that they received up front, worried about whether or not that they can meet the requirements to qualify for them. So, you know, specifically on the PPP, it's going to require a lot of planning to make sure that you're maximizing the forgiveness on the back end. Are you using it for employee payroll and healthcare and benefits? Making sure that you're tracking every expense that you're spending, and, you know, are you planning on the back end? Do you need to give some bonuses ahead of time? I read some articles last night about, you know, speeding up Christmas bonuses, things like that, to make sure that you're making sure that you use all of those for employee expenses.
So, Herd, let me come to you next. What should investors be looking at when they're evaluating revenue in an acquisition right now?
Yeah, and I think this was brought up on the prior panel, really looking at things at a much more granular level than maybe has been done in the past. You can't just look at the last, you know, 12 months and expect the volume levels are going to be the same. It's really digging into what volume has been impacted. So really looking at March and April, how those dropped. And then as we come out of things, what's coming back and what will come back to maybe a more normal level, but then also what is going to fundamentally change, and are there volumes that are going away? And so it's understanding the volume side of it. And then really the next piece of it is understanding reimbursement levels and understanding how are you driving your profit by service line, and where's cross-subsidization going on that you can't count on in the future if it's a more acute care, a more broad spectrum type facility. And really, do you have a good matching between revenue and expenses on the service lines, and how much risk is there in a shift in service mix? We've just seen acute care hospitals have seen a massive shift in service mix in the last 2 months, and what's that look like going forward? So I think it's just a much more granular look at everything.
Does anybody else want to address that one about what? Yeah, we'll let you unpack it a little bit, maybe a little bit later. So anybody else want to jump in on sort of what investors should be looking at in evaluating revenue?
Yeah, Bobby, I'm happy to. Just in terms of revenue alone, you start to consider volume. It's still kind of an unknown of whether people can get back to 100%. You know, what are the protocols? What's the requirement? Will your providers work the extra time in the day? Maybe they will for the first 6 weeks or 2 months because they're just excited not to be home with their kids barging in all the time. But, you know, how long are they willing to work 10-hour days, 12-hour days, because they've got a lot of turnover time in exam rooms and operating theaters that's in excess of what it was previously? But can you also supplement that with telehealth? You know, what's the trade-off? Can you make up for lost in-clinic volume, face-to-face volume with telehealth, and how does that play out?
Anybody else on that one?
Hey, Bobby, if I could add a couple of things, I would say even digging below the clouds, if you will, and looking at the underlying referral sources.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
Or if those have been schools and sports programs, and if those have been disrupted due to COVID, then making simple assumptions that volumes will return over some period of time. I agree with the term granular and looking at things at a very detailed level, which can clearly vary from market to market. But I think if one tries to look at, well, where were the referrals coming from in the past, and what are the drivers of those, and what's the likelihood of those continuing in the future? The key considerations.
Got it. All right. So, Justin, let me come back to you. Tell me what Graham Healthcare Capital is excited about in the short term for investing.
Yeah, so when we acquire a platform, we acquire it with the intention of holding it for decades. So we're always sort of thinking about the long-term win. I think what's changed recently is what is the shift in the long-term win? And so what new markets does that have us thinking about? And then we're also value buyers. I think everybody wants to be a value buyer, but so what are those businesses that are suffering in the short term, but we think still play really well in the long term, that may create value on the pickup? And some of those things that are top of mind have already been mentioned on this call, but CCM, chronic care management, telehealth, hospital at home programs, things that move away from aggregate care settings, we believe are going to have longer term dynamics.
Okay. Anybody else want to talk about sort of what the capital, what the investors should be excited about for the short term in investing? All right. Let me put this one out to everybody and we'll see who jumps in first. What do valuations look like in healthcare M&A as it comes back? And I would love thoughts on different subsectors. For example, Justin, you came up in post-acute. That might be great to sort of think about that one, and other people to throw your answers out for different subsectors. So what do valuations look like as we come back, as healthcare M&A comes back? Anybody?
Bobby, I'm happy to get
all right. I've got
so I would say.
Thanks,
I'm sorry. Did I preempt somebody?
No, go for it.
So
nope. You're doing great.
Yeah, clearly, I think it's a sector by sector kind of analysis. For instance, hospitals. It seems that at least for publicly traded hospital prices, they've suffered, as well as ASC type of companies that were involved in elective surgical procedures. And versus telehealth, where teledoc's price is just absolutely soaring, or in the case of dialysis services like DaVita. So I think it clearly is a sector by sector kind of an analysis, and it goes to what volumes were most disrupted during this period and how quickly will that disruption turn itself around. So I think, again, sector by sector, frankly, some winners, some losers.
Yeah, pick any one sector and give us some thoughts on it. But yeah, go ahead.
Don mentioned hospitals and ASDs, and we do a lot of work in those areas. And frankly, it's too early to tell. Don was talking about discount rates and our cost of capital and it going up, and that'll drive values down because of the risk. You know, really, until we have a few more months of history and can see our volumes going to come back, how are people scared to stay away still, and what's that look like? We're still sort of in the middle of it from my perspective, and it's tough to really see what that looks like. We need a few more months of history under our belts before we can really see how that shakes out.
So that's sort of the falling knife issue, right? That everybody is, as we're looking at what it is, everybody's afraid of catching the falling knife. Or maybe I'm saying it to the negative one when we're all saying it positive, right? Did I just say glass half empty? Is that what I said?
Sounds like it.
Bobby, so
I'll take an easy one.
Go ahead. Yep.
What was the post-acute that you mentioned? I think if you can shift to pre-acute, or really non-acute, if those businesses can diversify that way and rebrand themselves that way, I think there's a real opportunity.
Yeah, Bobby, I'll take maybe an easy one, behavioral health. So just within that, we've actually talked to a couple MAT businesses, and they're actually beating budget because people still need that support. And so I think those valuations will continue to stay really strong. They're really, I won't say pandemic proof, but they've certainly excelled. But also autism treatment, ABA services, from what we've also heard, there'll probably be a big push in that because as parents spend more time with their children that need help, it's more clarified that yes, they need help. And the ones that were on service, when they stop treatment for a period of time, they actually need more help to get back to where they were. So there's probably a kind of a backlog of kids that haven't been getting help, in addition to just an increase in the overall patient count, just from identified issues where schools have said, we think your kid needs help. And parents have said, no, they're good. I'm only with them in the afternoon. So it's not a big deal. So I think there's two pieces in behavioral and a lot of others for that matter, that'll certainly excel.
So I bet behavioral and telehealth, we can all agree, are probably going to do very well as it moves forward. What else does well? I'm going to give you a few other sectors that do well. Okay, I'll be investing in telehealth and in. Say again, Connie.
I just might jump in and say some of the life sciences entities too, we're seeing some activity, you know, genetics testing, clinical research, those seem to be, you know, coming back pretty strong as well.
So jump into life sciences for a minute. Do we expect a lot of growth from the pandemic on the life sciences side? Is this an opportunity for that side of the industry? Connie, let me put that one back to you, and then we can have other people jump in.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're working on a couple of things right now where we're seeing the transaction activity not dropping off too much, and perhaps some, you know, new lines of business or new studies popping up due to the pandemic, and, you know, how to deal with things like this in the future now that we're, you know, we're getting exposed to it now, and how can we better deal with these in the future? So I think we are seeing some good activity, you know, maybe not how we want to see it, but we certainly are seeing some of our clients have some nice activity happening right now.
So to the rest of the panel, as we look at sort of life sciences and the current pandemic and the opportunities it creates, do we see more integration with providers, or do you think we have a period of a lot of creative destruction while we try to integrate the technology with the providers? What's everybody think? I'm gonna call on somebody.
I think we will see more creative in interaction. I think some of the barriers have been broken down in terms of how quickly they're trying to move towards vaccines and sharing of information, even across, you know, companies, states, that type of thing. So I do think that it'll be a big kickstart for it. And in terms of life sciences, I think what I've heard initially was, you know, there was a horrified moment for CROs a month or two ago because they realized, wait, all of our physicians are being pulled to hospitals, especially in Europe, to serve patients. And so we're not sure we can continue the studies that we've been doing for 3 months, and we're gonna have to tell these patients that we're gonna have to start over and scrap what we've done. So, I mean, that played out and doesn't seem to have really come to fruition, but I think there was a very tense couple of days for those guys.
Huh, that's
yeah,
a great way to put it.
Bobby, go ahead.
Yep, I heard Don and I heard you come in.
Okay. Now, I was going to say, I think big picture, I think this certainly continues integration amongst providers. And I'm thinking of if you have physician groups, if you have professional providers that were kind of remaining independent and what one, I think through the disruption they've gone through, it's going to cause people who maybe were on the fence said, well, I need to be a part of something bigger. I think you see it there, but also I think you see payers and providers becoming more collaborative and maybe less adversarial in the way they're handling their managed care contracts and the way they're handling payment reimbursement because, again, a big wave has washed over the hospitals and the payers are going to need to be more collaborative in the way they're helping them through that. And so I see this spurring some innovative and maybe speeding up some trend lines that were already in place.
Right, so Don and then Justin, I think you both had comments on it. Don, do you want to jump in?
Sure, I can make mine pretty quick. I think COVID has exposed various vulnerabilities in our healthcare system. So when I think of life sciences and relationships with providers, I think of supply chain, and I think of if there's been some vulnerabilities that have been exposed, then perhaps that's an opportunity to help alleviate that. Meaning if a lot of our drugs and meds and medical supplies were offshore, and there's an opportunity to perhaps bring those back more domestic, then that could present some opportunities for domestic-based life sciences companies.
Great. Justin, did you want to jump in on that one too? I think I might have heard you coming in. Nope. Okay. Got it. All right. Chris, I think you're back with us. So thank you. I was going to say that if we couldn't figure out how to get you back, we'd make you a guest on the podcast, and I would also get you on one of our quarterlies because I want actually to get your opinions on several things. So let me take us back. We were talking about the access positions, and my question had been, tell me what makes you passionate about access positions and its mission in the new healthcare reality. Can you give us that answer and come back around to that one?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So, apologize for the irony, the telemedicine guy unable to do the teleconference, but anyway, so the passion for
I actually don't think it's your fault. I think it's our fault, not yours, just so we're clear. So,
appreciate it. So I think just kind of stepping back in terms of the passion for, patient care, that's something that's, you can have a lot of passion for in itself. You're caring for another person, which there's a lot of passion there, but there's a lot of barriers. And a lot of those barriers are due to change, and change in healthcare is really tough. And so because of this tragedy with the pandemic, it has forced incredible change within healthcare, and it's really opened the minds. And so I think what really drives us is that now there's an incredibly new opportunity, and there's an appetite for change. And telemedicine has been seen by so many, experienced by so many as a positive tool that we really feel like this has really opened the door. It's been an incredible catalyst for change. And I think ultimately this will be a good thing for healthcare as people get creative and innovative about how to apply telemedicine to care for patients virtually in a more efficient way, and oftentimes in a higher touch way than you could with traditional models. So that's, I think, really it's really lighting a fire in reinvigorating our passion for patient care.
We had a moment while you were off while we decided that the best investments were telemedicine, behavioral care, and life sciences. So congratulations. All right. Let's see. Don, let me ask you, how do valuation methods change in the new reality? What about the discount rates and the multiples?
Sure. So I would say pre-COVID, there might be a tendency for PE firms, investment bankers, and the investment community to look at pricing deals based on pro forma earnings times some reasonable market multiple. Market multiple may range depending on whether the target is a platform entity, which may be a larger entity versus a smaller bolt-on to a platform. Usually the multiples might be smaller for the bolt-on versus the platform. So looking ahead under COVID, if you break that formula down, pro forma revenues could be very difficult to project, number one, which tries to project a single period earnings performance in a period that there will be inevitably ramp-ups to try to get to prior COVID performance levels. So trying to use a single period picture for earnings, I don't think will necessarily be reasonable. That lends itself more to a multi-period discounted cash flow analysis as opposed to a single period method using a market multiple. And then that market multiple itself, if that market multiple had been based on prior precedent transactions that parties were selling at pre-COVID, buying and selling at pre-COVID, which took into consideration, at least it implied, a certain level of growth and profitability and risk all baked into that market multiple. And now that's been turned over on its head to some degree, then one might question the use of historical multiples in a period where the future may look drastically different, at least over some period of time, than what the past. So the summary answer is, I think using a multi-period discounted cash flow that allows for the ramping up of a business, and then reassessing the discount rates to use specific to that business and its projected cash flows and risk around them. In my opinion, I think that would be a more reasonable approach to use as we go forward.
Anybody else have an opinion they want to throw in on that? Okay. Connie, let me ask you. So are there any major auditing or accounting changes that are going to affect healthcare businesses coming out of the pandemic that our audience should anticipate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's different accounting questions with almost each of these funding sources. You know, we have the Medicare advances that have come out, which is basically just a cash flow mechanism to receive a little bit of cash now that will have to be repaid later, that starts accruing interest if you don't get that all recouped by Medicare at a certain point. You know, we're telling providers to be very careful on these HHS grants that have been given out as well. You know, when you have private equity companies or for-profit healthcare entities getting grants that are usually reserved for not-for-profit or hospital systems, there's different accounting that comes along with those. So you have to be very careful, like I mentioned earlier, that you're tracking the expenses, you're not expending on things that the grants aren't allowed for, because those could be subject to audit after the fact. We did get some good news from the Financial Accounting Standards Board that they delayed leases for another year for for-profit entities. So something that everybody was going to have to be dealing with this summer, we did get a good delay of another year on that in the FASB. So yeah, but you know, the one thing that everybody's asking is, we get calls from the CFOs, what are the accounting consequences of all these things? So we're tracking those very closely.
Thanks, Connie. Anybody else want to jump in on that one? And then I'll go to our last question. Okay. Everybody, let me ask you, what have you binge watched during the pandemic? Or what's the best pandemic movie or series you've watched? let's start with you in the bottom left, as it were.
Sure. The fabulous Mrs. Maisel, caught up on that. I've heard people talk about it. It's a good show. And I did watch Outbreak. It was on Netflix. And just, you know, when this started, I watched Outbreak just to make myself, you know, even more anxious. So,
Marshall, how about you?
I'm the same. I haven't had time to actually binge watch shows at this point, but hopefully I'll get there. But I'm the same. I have watched Outbreak and have steeled myself during this, knowing that Cuba Gooding Jr. and Dustin Hoffman are ready to synthesize something and save us all whenever called upon. So that's how I've made it through.
Justin.
Hey, growing up in Chicago, I've been watching The Last Dance. Tribute to the great Michael Jordan and the Bulls run for a second three-peat.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Chris?
So I've always had a wish to be able to work on my own car. Never been able to get there, but I've been trying to learn by watching Wheeler Dealers, I should say.
That's awesome. All right. Connie?
I think I'm probably the opposite of everybody else. After 14 hours of pandemic talk every day, I like to watch a couple episodes of Schitt's Creek before bed and get some good laughs in. Go to bed on a happy note.
Good show.
All right, and Don?
Yeah, great variety from the panelists. I'll have to say The Last Dance, although I'm not Chicago, I'm Dallas, but certainly a Michael Jordan fan. And then a couple of dramas, a TV or a movie series called Safe, which was really good. And then The Blacklist. So try to get a little variety. Yeah.
I would like to note that for all of our panelists, you all appear to have had haircuts since the beginning of the pandemic. I can't figure out how to do that. You guys have all done a great job. So if you've got any tips for me, tell me where to go get my haircut. A couple of you are in Nashville. You can tell me what to do. All right. Great job to all. Thank you very much. So if you can exit out of the screen, greatly appreciated. And I'm going to basically take us to our break. So thanks to all the panelists. As I told everyone at the beginning, we would have some short vignettes about the virtues and obstacles of remote working. So Maggie, I'm going to let you hit that right now.
January, February, March, 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 April.
All right. So thank you to everyone for joining us for the morning sessions. We will move to Salon 2 for our lunch economic keynote here. That will start at 11:30. So we've got about a 15-minute break, actually a 12-minute break now. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this morning. Be sure to join us for the keynote here in a few minutes. Thanks to all of our speakers on this. And when you have just a minute, Siri apparently wants to talk to me right now. When you have just a minute, please fill out the survey. If you look on your screen all the way to the right, the survey is there. It is 6 questions, and we would love your input as our audience on those questions. Now on the break would be a great time to do that. And we'll see you again in about 12 minutes. Thank you.